I'm blooming knackered, Glyn. Absolutely knackered.
What have you been up to then?
Well, I got my daughter staying for the week, she brought a dog with her. You know how much I like dogs.
Oh, I know you absolutely love dogs.
Adore dogs.
You can't get enough of them.
Absolutely. So the bloody thing is absolute pain in the neck. And we took it for a walk last night. We came back in the dark, got him indoors, and he's running around, and there's blood everywhere, all over the floors and the furniture. He gashed his paw. He's mad as a bucket of frogs, and he didn't care, and he was just scampering around. And so we ended up with the emergency vets and got home about 1 o'clock in the morning. So 313 quid poorer.
I mean, just these things will just enhance your love of
that. It will, yes. I've got my order in now.
Okay, welcome to another Hidden Wiltshire podcast. We're now up to podcast 17. My name is Glyn Coy. I run the Hidden Wiltshire Project, and with me I have my usual podcast partner.
Paul Timlett, if I can stay awake.
So, as usual, we start these podcasts off with a brief recap of what's been going on over the last couple of weeks, and quite a bit from my perspective.
Yeah.
I've been on holiday. I managed to escape from Wiltshire.
So do tell.
Yeah, and it's funny because whenever I go on holiday, I always drag my family around to look at old stones and historical sites and things like that. But
they're probably used to seeing old fossils at home, aren't they?
Yeah. Very funny, very funny. Less of the old, please. I went to Pembrokeshire, and in the back of my mind, I was determined to go and visit this place called Morne Warn, which I discovered last year sometime actually was really important because of its links to Wiltshire. So it was great to be out in Pembroke and find a little bit of, or a little link to Wiltshire as well. So, but basically Morne Warn, I think it's Welsh for peat bog or peat something. But it was the site of a Neolithic, early Bronze Age stone circle. And over that way is the Presilly Hills, where we know that that's where the blue stones were basically quarried, and that ended up at Stonehenge. But in this site was a blue stone circle, about 110 metres in diameter, so quite similar in size to the blue stone circle, the original blue stone circle around Stonehenge. And there was some archaeology done over the last couple of years that came up with some pretty strong evidence that pointed to the fact that this blue stone circle in Pembrokeshire was there for about 300 years, and it was probably dismantled. And then the people that lived there transported it 150 plus miles to Wiltshire and re-erected it on the Stonehenge site. And it just made me sort of think, I mean, what on earth would motivate the community to unite around moving these 2 to 4 ton blue stones, loads of them, you know, all the way across the Wiltshire and re-erect them. I mean, something major was going on there, but it was fascinating to stand there because there were two or three stones still left behind. It was quite an evocative place to stand and
As I was saying after my trip to Shetland and Orkney, the world was, I mean, back then in the sort of, if you say Neolithic or early Bronze Age, whenever it was far more connected than perhaps we realised, and you know, we think, you know, how those people would have travelled. I mean, certainly in terms of Orkney, they got to get across the sea, and you know, from the Presilly Hills, at some point they got across the River Severn. But you know, it's all on foot. They didn't hop on a train or anything. So,
that's the thing. I mean, it's just the sheer thought of doing it on foot is bad enough.
Yeah, exactly.
Dragging those stones as well. It's just unimaginable. Something major must have been motivating them to do it. And obviously, we're a bit biased because we think Wiltshire's a fantastic place to migrate to. Um, But just the whole thought process and the logistics around it are just astounding.
Yeah. And I was having this debate with somebody the other day, I can't remember who it was now, about saying, well, you know, the slaves that they used to build these monuments. And, you know, I said, well, I'm not sure they were slaves. I think they actually did it willingly. And that's, you know, say, I think that's what I've read, in that they were sort of united behind something that bound them together. And this was just something that the whole community, the wider community, believed in and supported.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, I mean, just the mind boggles, doesn't it, to think dragging those stones that distance, which is, I mean, God, how far is that? 170 miles, something like that?
Yeah, I think it's 100, it's about 150 as the crow flies, so right. They're going to be going close to 200
yeah.
miles following the contours of the land.
And then, as I said, getting them across the water at some point, whether they went north or south, you know, across the River Severn. But, so, I mean, I don't know if you said, but I mean, obviously what we're talking about here is Pembrokeshire, so right down in the far southwest of Wales. The other thing, by the time this comes out on Sunday, we will have done another Wiltshire Museum walk.
Yes.
Where are we going?
The hills above Eddington this week. So we're going to take in Tin Head Hill and Pickett Hill around there. So nice circular route. And obviously accompanied by David Dawson's Wealth Museum, who occasionally brings things along with him from the archive, which is really interesting. So yeah, by the time we hear this, will have done it.
Yeah. And are we going, or did we go to the Tin Head, the actual Long Barrow? Or is that
no,
just,
I mean, the Long Barrow, the Long Barrow itself is kind of surrounded by crops.
Yeah.
So you can admire it from afar.
Yeah.
But can't get right up to it. And it's fenced off anyway, so it's a bit of a...
No, I just wondered if the museum had got permission to go out and have a look. But, I haven't been out there for a while, so I don't know what the farmer's growing in that field. But as you say, it's cultivated. There's always crops there. So.
Yeah. I think he's got barley or wheat in there this year. Last year it was rapeseed, but more of a yellow crop. But he may have actually cut it back by the time we go.
Who knows? Yeah, I know around here they're sort of harvesting at the moment. And Ellie Grant, who's does the magnificent seed, the rapeseed oil, I was chatting to her the other day when I went up to the farm to get some oil, and she was about to start that day, which is, God, what day was that? Wednesday, I think. They were hoping to start harvesting that afternoon. But barley and wheat they were bringing in as well.
Yeah, I noticed the last couple of weeks there's, you can see some fields that have been half-harvested.
Mm.
They've kind of got halfway through and then timed out before the rains come back. And they have to wait then until it's bone dry.
Yeah, we were with Doug last night. It was exactly that. They'd done part of it and had to stop because there'd been so much rain.
Yeah.
But, of course, what does grow incredibly well in this weather is ragwort.
Yes.
It's bloody everywhere.
It is everywhere. It's having a good year.
Ragwort. It is. Good year for ragwort. It's, not for anybody else. But. So again, by the time this comes out on Sunday, you may well be listening to this whilst Glyn and I are pulling ragwort up at East Hill Farm for Frank, the Guy family who farm up there. Because you and I went to see Frankie, the daughter is sort of taking over the farm from her parents gradually, and there's no question they're drowning in ragwort up there.
Yeah, it's funny because we met Frankie on one of our many missions to rope people into coming on this podcast in the future. We've ended up getting a small team together to go up and pull ragwort for the day.
Yeah, if we're following wind, we may have as many as 10 people on Sunday, which would be fantastic. But she's great fun. It's going to be a really good podcast when we get her on, and she'll show us around the farm as she did for you and I. And it's as you were saying at the time, it's a fantastic part of Imber, the Imber Plain, bits that you can't go, you'll never see.
Yeah,
and they're farming up.
It was quite funny because when we did it, we got shoved in the back of a Land Rover, and the back of the Land Rover is open. It's like a pickup truck, right? So we're sat in the back.
Yeah,
but driving up onto parts of the farm which are in the danger area where you can't go as a member of the public. Yeah. So it was, yeah, it's good to see those views. Never seen them before from those angles.
Absolutely. And the great thing is on Sunday we're going to have some of the I don't know if they're podcast listeners, but they're certainly on the Facebook group. So we've had some volunteers from there, which is fantastic. Yeah. So a mixture of Hidden Wiltshire followers and some of the Natural England team.
Yeah, yeah.
So just hope the rain holds off. So what are we going to talk about today then? We've got a little walk planned, haven't we?
Yeah, another one of the walks that we've had on the website, and I thought it'd be good this week to go to back to the south of Wiltshire, to an absolutely glorious area where you did a walk. Was it last year or the year before?
I was looking at my old post. The post was the 10th of June 2020. It was last year. I can't remember what I did the actual walk. Obviously, some days before that. I normally write them up very quickly, otherwise I forget. I forget where I went. So.
But this one we've curiously called Eden's Last Post. So, Eden's Last Post. What's all that about?
Yes. Well, we'll find out in a minute. But it's a reference to Anthony Eden. So, this is a walk that it's an area that I haven't been to for years. And this sort of the Anthony Eden connection I discovered many, many years ago. And I thought, I really must go back and do a walk around there. And so the walk starts in Ebsbourne Wake, which is right down in the far southwest of Wiltshire. In fact, you can see the badlands of Dorset from down there. That's how remote it is. And it's a walk along. You do sort of start along the Ebble Valley, the River Ebble, and then up into the hills, and then back down through Prescombe Down, which is a Natural England nature reserve. So it's a nice long circuit. The walk was about, I've written here, 12 kilometres, which is about 8 miles. I've actually, if you want to follow along with this, there's a post on the website, and it's called Eden's Last Post, and there's a map on there. Of the walk. I think when I looked at that, it measured in miles. It was sort of 8.5 miles or something like that. But I think the initial challenge you get down there is parking. So I parked. I was lucky. I got parked right in the middle of Ebsbourne Wake itself, which is, I mean, if you ever sort of walk around there or drive around there, I mean, it certainly wasn't designed for motorised vehicles.
Yeah.
I mean, the lanes and the streets were built in the days of horse and cart and pedestrians. So driving through there is, it's very easy to sort of come around a bend and be confronted by, you know, a delivery truck or a bus or whatever, and then you have the sort of the usual Mexican standoff as to who's going to give way. So I'd driven sort of round and round the village because I didn't want to sort of block the road or block anybody's drive, and that was a real challenge, finding somewhere. And I sort of drove up and down about three times, and I saw a couple of blokes come out from a driveway, and I said, is there anywhere to park? And I'd driven past this bus stop twice, and they said, just park at the bus stop. And I said, but I'll block the bus. And he said, oh, everybody does it. Don't worry about that. And because I'd already seen the bus. And he said, it only comes twice a day, so I knew I was okay to the evening. So, yeah, there's a bus stop on what's called Handley Street, and it's just, I can't remember how far it was, sort of 50 metres or whatever, 100 metres from the Horseshoe Inn. So there's a little pull-in. So you've got the bus stop, and it's like an extended pull-in, so there is room to tuck a couple of cars in there. But I can imagine that would get pretty busy in more normal times. The other place to park is there's a road called Top Road, and it literally is, you've got kind of two roads that head sort of east-west along the Ebble Valley there, and you've got the Top Road and the Bottom Road, and they're sort of parallel with each other, and as the name suggests, the Bottom Road is down in the valley bottom and the Top Road is slightly up the slopes. And on Top Road, as you head towards a hamlet called West End, which is between Ebsbourne Wake and Alfdiston, there's quite a long lay-by there, so that's probably a better place to park. And in fact, on my walk, I ended up walking past that lay-by and thought to myself, oh, that would have been a better spot. But of course, the appeal of parking in the village is that you could end the walk with a pint in the Horseshoe Inn. But basically, what I did was head to the aforementioned West End, which bears no relation at all to its more famous the place that it shares its name. There's a name for something called like that, isn't it? What's it? I can't remember. They share the name, but nothing else. So West End is this sort of little hamlet, and it's built up around a sort of little crossroads. It's where Top Road and Bottom Road meet, and I think there's another little lane. And I guess would the hamlet have come first, or would the junction have come first? I don't know, but that's obviously why they sort of coexist. They sit by side. It's an important meeting place of tiny tracks. But basically, what you need to do is just pick a route. And again, if you look at the map, I think there's a footpath across fields that runs right next to the Ebble. Now, the Ebble here, this must be the area where the River Ebble rises, because when I went, it was completely dry. So it was just like a grassy, it wasn't even a hollow, a slight grassy depression running along the sort of heading westwards, which was the direction I was going, across the meadows. I followed that, the line of the Ebble. It's one of Wiltshire's classic chalk streams when it's in spate, and a bit further down the valley, obviously it doesn't dry out in the summer. And it's one of these beautiful, sort of crystal clear Wiltshire chalk streams. But as you basically what you're doing now is you're heading towards Alfdiston. I don't know how you pronounce that, Alfdiston or Alfdiston, but you're heading there.
It's a weird one, isn't it? Because I'd look at it and think, is it Alfdiston or Alfdiston? Anyone's local and knows, please let us know.
Yes, no, yeah. Actually, you've hit upon something there. It may well be. I don't know what the original name was, because it's Alfdiston is a pretty ancient settlement. So obviously they'd have pronounced it differently in hundreds of years ago. And I'm sure it wouldn't have been spelt the same. But as I was walking along the valley there, it's quite a big house sort of swings into view, pretty early on, and the church. So the house is the old rectory, as you would imagine, and next to it is St Mary's Church, which apparently sort of dates back to at least the 12th century. And I was reading up about the St Mary's Church the other day, and because of course there's all these things, I didn't do enough research before I did the walk. I just went and walked, I then did my research afterwards, and I mean the church was locked anyway. I couldn't go in, but apparently there's a load of monuments in there to the Wyndham family, which is a family that they owned sort of huge estates across Devon, Somerset, and Wiltshire. It's a name that you see frequently around Wiltshire, you know, in our part of the world. In fact, there's a Wyndham Arms in Salisbury. So yeah, all these sort of memorials to the Wyndham family. But the Anthony Eden connection is that Anthony Eden, who was the British Prime Minister, he was actually the Prime Minister during the Suez Crisis, which was 1956. He had the misfortune of being the Prime Minister then, and not one of our greatest periods in history, I suspect.
No, I mean, he's regarded as one of the sort of worst Prime Ministers, which is probably a bit harsh, but his tenure was...
brief.
Unfortunately, like Tony Blair gets linked to the Iraq disaster, he gets linked to Suez, and that was a foreign policy disaster for Great Britain, unfortunately.
I think I'm right in saying was he Foreign Secretary or Foreign and Commonwealth Secretary before he became Prime Minister? But he actually lived in Alfriston Manor
for
a number of years. And then when he died in 1977, he was buried in St Mary's Church. So as you sort of come in to the sort of the front gates, as it were, with the path leading up to the door, his grave is on the right in the churchyard there, or his tomb. And it's sort of... it's got little sort of descriptions of his life, you know, his offices, the offices that he held in government on sort of each side of the tomb. But it's become very worn. I mean, bear in mind, it's not that long ago that he died, 1977, and in some places you can't actually read what's written, carved into the stone. So I can imagine it won't be that long in the annals of time when he won't be able to read it at all.
I think when he retired, he did retire to Wiltshire, and he lived in Broadchalk for a bit before he bought I struggle to say that word.
Alfriston
Manor.
Yeah.
And even kept a bit of livestock for a while. So he.
Oh, did he?
He very much kept a low profile.
Mm.
Not like some of these other ex-prime ministers that still... commentating on the news and things like that. He very much did retire.
Yeah. It's one of those sort of parts of the world where you can sort of tuck yourself away and apart from the locals, nobody knows you down there. And as I said, I'll probably keep saying this, it's such a peaceful part of the world and lovely place to hide away if that's what you want. Mm. From the church, I just continued to head sort of west along the valley, and it opens up, and it's almost flat apart from, as I say, this sort of ditch, which is where the Ebble would flow in wetter times, and quite a big sort of open meadow, beautiful spot, and then off to your sort of half right, as you can see what is Norrington Manor, which is a stunning sort of medieval manor house. I think it was built in the 14th century by John, I don't know how to pronounce this, Gawain, G-A-W-E-N. So if you think Gawain and the Green Knights, the sort of legend of Gawain and the Green Knights, that's the same family. Built in the 14th century. Unfortunately, it's not open to the public because the Sykes family live there now. In fact, I was reading that only three families have ever owned the Norrington Manor. So you've got the Gawains who built it, and then the Wyndhams, the aforementioned Wyndhams.
Yeah.
And then the current incumbents... The Sykes family, I met what I think may have been Mrs. Sykes at the front of the house. I'm going to do feel for them a bit. That Norrington Manor is sort of bounded on. There's at least two, possibly three public rights of way, like all around the house.
Right, so you can get pretty close up to it.
So there was a sort of driveway came up from the centre of the village from Alf Diston and comes up to the house, and then the footpath that I was on goes right in front of a hedge, which kind of leads into, you know, the little driveway area. I was sort of stood there with my map and I was looking at the house, and I had my camera around my neck at the time. Normally I tuck it away, but I actually had the camera out, and this lady just sort of come out, and she was just getting in her car. So she was only not very far away. I mean, far enough for me to speak to her. And I said, "Oh, you know, it's a lovely house. Do you live here?" And she said, "You know, yes, we do." And then she looked at my camera, and she said, she was quite polite, but she sort of said, "You don't want people taking photographs of it." And I said, okay. And she said, you know, if you've got any photographs on there, can you delete them? And I said, well, I haven't actually taken any photographs, but the house, you know, I'm on a public footpath, public right of way. There's 100 pictures, 1,000 pictures of Norrington Manor on the internet. And she sort of looked aghast, and she said, well, is there? I said, well, yes, you know, and it's marked on the map. I said, everybody knows it's here. And, I mean, it's not like she was some old fossil. I mean, she's probably younger than me, but she really didn't like the fact that I might have taken a picture of the front of her house. So, as I say, it was, you know, polite, but sort of, you know, slightly frosty conversation. And, you know, I didn't, you know, I respected her wishes. I didn't take many pictures. I took one or two, but I didn't put them anywhere. They're not on my website. They're not on the Hidden Wiltshire website. You know, I just took them for myself. But I mean, you know, just Google Norrington Manor and you'll see any number of photographs of it. And you know, a little bit about the interior as well, because I think there's some really quite stunning architectural features in the house. But I always think of these big old houses, in some ways they're maybe a bit of a poison chalice. You know, you're custodian of a piece of history and people want to see it, but it's, yeah, it's your home, and you know, and you perhaps want a bit of privacy. But the Sykes family farm there, so it's not just a manor house, it's a working farm. And I do recall when I posted this back in 2020, somebody on the Facebook site said that I think they knew the Sykes family, and they said, you know, they're terribly nice. I think, you know, from what I recall, you know, they're acutely aware of the fact that they're custodians of this piece of history. It didn't put me in a great mood having had that conversation. So I sort of, you know, said goodbye, and she said, "Have a nice day," and we, you know, we parted company. But from there, you kind of continue to head west, and in the distance, I just remember seeing. I stopped at one point, and I took a photograph I think it was a gate and the footpath sign, and sort of off to the west, you can see Wynn Green, which is a beautiful place to walk. I mean, that's right on the border of Dorset and Wiltshire, and it's absolutely stunning up there. And in fact, for anybody who's into photography and has heard of Charlie Waite, he's a very famous British landscape photographer. That's one of his favourite places to photograph, and he's taken some beautiful photographs on Wynn Green and has sold the prints for an awful lot of money as well. But from Wynn Green, you get sort of great views of. Not from Wynn Green, from the footpath where you can see Wynn Green, and you can see, you know, Woodlands Down, which is sort of where the walk kind of heads up, but all this, this sort of range of hills that are around you. I'm trying to find my note as to what the landmarks were. But, it's in the blog. I'll find it in a minute whilst we're talking. But some beautiful views there. So you kind of just continue along heading west, but at some point the route finding gets a bit tricky because you head west and then you sort of swing round and head north. So basically your next waypoint is really what you're heading to is this place called Gallows Hill and White Sheet Hill. So that's off to the north, and you know, it's sort of, you know, a bit of a climb to get up there. Now there are footpaths and rights of way, but they were incredibly overgrown when I walked along right. there. You know, stinging nettles, a go-go. And I completely lost the track at one point. And as I said in the blog, you know, looking back in hindsight, there was a fence line that I should have been following. But there were no signs. I couldn't see any way signs. But I should have sort of stuck to a fence, and you end up going through a little wood and then coming out onto what is Woodlands Down that I mentioned earlier on. Woodlands Down is actually open access. So again, I was sort of looking for rights of way, and it was only afterwards when I got home and I looked at my 1 to 25,000 map, I realised that the Woodlands Down is open access. So I was trying to stick doggedly to a path, and I could have just, you know, walked right across the face of the down. But so Woodlands Down, it's not a big open access area. It's quite a small plot on the side of a hill, and you've got all these, I don't know if it's just soil slip or strip lynchets, but you've got these sort of little terraces that sort of ripple down the side yeah. of the hill, and then down at the bottom there is a house sort of tucked away in the trees called Woodlands, and that looked lovely down there. I didn't want to sort of wander down the drive to look at it, but you know, sitting up on the slopes of Woodlands Down, you could sort of see it nestled in the trees there. Again, very 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 peaceful. But as I sort of went across Woodlands Down, there was basically what I did. I walked across it, not realising it was open access, and I found this little stone man just sitting on the side of the hill. And there's a photograph of him on the on the blog. So no idea who he is, what he is. It's like having a gnome, just, you know, finding a gnome parked somewhere for no apparent reason. But it was just it wasn't very big. It was just sort of a block of stone with this funny little face carved on the side of it. Because I kind of walked up to him and then walked back the way I'd come, thinking, oh, if I've strayed off the path, then I should be following the path somewhere. But I did end up following a gully, a sort of hollowway that went sort of diagonally up the slope. It was actually, you know, it's worthwhile just following that as well, because again you could see all these sort of ripples in the bank mm-hmm. where, and if you look at the map, there doesn't seem to be any, you know, settlement there. It's certainly don't think it's a hill fort, but it had that sort of look about it. But it's sort of cut, the track was cut deep into the chalk, so you've got this kind of white chalk scar across the you know, running diagonally up the side of the hill. And I do recall sort of getting up to the top where it sort of levels out, and then off to my left was just the most stunning bottom, one of my favourite bottoms in Wiltshire, and it's got no name. So the bottom with no name. So I can't even say to you, go and have a look at such and such a bottom. It's nameless, but it was beautiful. I sat there and had a coffee and looked out across the landscape there. But again, sort of looking at the map, my next reference point, my next target was Gallows Hill that I mentioned earlier on. And I remember, again, you're sort of circuiting, or you're by this time you're quite high up, and you're following round the sort of the bowl, another bottom. And in fact, that one does have a name, and I can't remember what it is, but the view's there. You're looking all the way down the sort of bowl, right down to back to Alfdiston and Norrington Manor, which, you know, seems like a long way away from up there, even though you haven't walked that far. But the views from up there were just absolutely stunning. And you get to the top of Gallows Hill, where you're going round the top of the bowl, the top of the bottom, and there was a little bench up there, and that was just the perfect place to stop, and I had some lunch up there. But of course, again, sort of being, you know, the height of the first surge of, you know, the pandemic, there was almost nobody around, apart from, I saw, God, was it three or four, not old guys, but, well, they were old because they're about my age, I would say, but they were on mountain bikes, and they were just following the bridle way there, and I say it looked blooming tough going. It's beyond my levels of fitness these days. So, but I do remember sort of looking at them thinking, oh, I'm not sure you're supposed to be out in a group that big. You think, oh, what the hell? Leave them to it. It's not none of my business. I'm certainly not going to say anything.
Yeah, that bridle way that runs across the top there, It stretches for quite a distance, but I think that's the old road that went from Salisbury to Shaftesbury.
Well, yes, you come to that. So so these guys had obviously come off that.
Right, yeah.
And then they turned off it. I haven't got the map in front of me at the moment, but if I remember rightly, you turn off that old road and you head sort of southeast, only, you know, 100 metres, and you get to the top of Gallows Hill and the top of that bottom. I wish I could remember the name of that bottom. So that's where they'd come from.
Right.
And then if you're looking at a map, it says Crossdyke on it.
Yeah, so see that.
Crossdyke links that road to the bench that I was sitting
right.
on.
Right, right.
So that's where I went next, was walked up that sort of, or on the on along Crossdyke. I mean, literally, as I say, it's 100 metres, something like that. And then you join that road, the old Salisbury to Shaftesbury Road. That, interestingly, so that road was a section of the old London to Land's End Road, apparently, well, certainly London to Cornwall Road. And it's also, I saw an old map, 19th century or maybe early 20th century map, and it's also marked Herapath.
Right.
So, you know, one of these old military roads going back to, gosh, what? Well, I mean, King Alfred's time. At least then, which I hadn't realised before. I only found that out a couple of days ago. Just, you know, to say it was marked Herapath there.
Yeah, it's an interesting road. I think it did used to be the main, I think it was turnpiked.
It was, yes, yeah.
And at some point, the A30 was built and that took over.
Yeah.
Because I remember looking into this road a while back, and I wish I'd looked this up before this podcast, because I could talk with more authority. But I looked into it with Steve Dewey, and we discovered that at some point it fell out of favour, and the turnpike contract was removed and given to someone else to make the A30 route the main road.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I remember having the conversation with Steve about it, and we were sort of coming up with sort of theories as to why one route fell out of favour and another one was adopted. And I think apart from the just the physical location, because Stu and I were talking about this the other day, that some of these ancient trackways, you know, they were up on the heights, because presumably it was less boggy up there.
Yeah.
And you get sort of commanding views of where you're going and perhaps of any threat. But equally, in the winter, I mean, my God, it would be exposed up there. And I can't remember what the height was. There, if you've got the map open in front of you, just to the west of where that cross ditch meets that track, there's a spot height. There's a trig point. Is it 257 metres, something like that?
It's 213, I think.
213, is it?
Yeah.
So, you know, it's pretty high up there. And, of course, you're on the watershed. So you've got the Ebble Valley to the south. And then to the north, is, you know, the steep slopes. I mean, a bit further on, you've got Swallow Cliff down. And you're looking sort of right down, as you said, to where the A30 is and whatever the river is that runs along that valley. Is that the Chalk? No, it's not Chalk Valley. Nadder? I think it might be the Nadder Valley. Down there. But yeah, at some point, you know, the turnpike was moved down to the bottom of the valley, I think.
Yeah.
Or was it the other way around? And I think I sort of posited this theory that, because there was, I remember some local politician got involved, and there seemed to be a bit of sort of lobbying going on, and, you know, pitching one turnpike against another. Yeah. So there was certainly, to my mind, it looked like there was commercial interests involved, yeah. and politicians getting involved, advocating for their favourite, you know, commercial enterprise. And you know, did that explain why turnpike routes were changed? I don't know. Because obviously, I mean, if you, you know, you have a turnpike, you collect the dues for using the turnpike, but then, you know, businesses become established and inns get built, and
yep.
you know, the custom from people travelling on turnpikes is going to be important to the local inns, and the stabling for spare, you know, change of horses and all the rest of it. Mm. So, you know, it was probably fairly you know, lucrative business for the people that operated businesses along those routes, much as it is today, I suppose.
Yeah.
But that route, it was, I think they're probably the next two people I saw were local farmers, quite a young couple. And they sort of, because that old Salisbury to Shaftesbury route is, it is a byway, that's right. So you can drive on it, and as I say in the blog, in parts it was even tarmacked, but they were sort of like driving up and down it in one of these sort of Hilux pickups, and they sort of, I don't know what they're doing, but eventually the guy jumped out with his dog and headed off into the fields sort of that went down the slopes to the, you know, towards the A30. So whether he was sort of moving sheep around, I don't know, but say one of the few other people I saw that day. But that whole stretch along the ridge line there, I mean, it's like fantastic views. I mean, all the time you're just looking to your right, looking to the left, looking at these massive sweeping views, and which was, I mean, thankfully, because the actual way itself was it, I think I described it as a trudge, and it was getting very monotonous just in terms of underfoot. And I would imagine that in busier times, I think, you know, the green laning off-roading community, I think it does get a hammering. And I've been on all that track further west, and, you know, there was sort of motorbikes hurtling along there. And in fact, looking at the ground, you could see that it's pretty well used, and it's, in parts it's quite deeply rutted. And I think it would become an absolute quagmire in places. So the views I enjoyed very much, but the going was I enjoyed less so. And it, you know, basically I followed it for about 4 kilometres, I think. But so again, sort of trudged along that route, and there were sort of routes diving off to the right and to the left. And there's a lot of rights of way up there, and again marked on the map, lots of, you know, tumuli and all sorts of ancient features in the landscape, which, you know, I didn't really have time to sort of investigate. And a lot of them you couldn't get to anyway. They were in cultivated fields. So basically what I was looking for, and I hadn't really planned it in my head, I was just sort of making the route up as I went along, really, up there. But I wanted to, at some point, head back south and drop down back into the Ebble Valley, and there's three or four options. So again, if 12 kilometres is a bit too long for you, you can sort of cut it short and drop back down into the Ebble Valley. But I sort of carried on almost to the last point at which I could head south. Basically what I was trying to do was head into Prescombe Down, which I mentioned earlier on. It's a Natural England Nature Reserve. So I sort of dropped down into the reserve at its point furthest east. And if you look at the blog and the photographs, there was a path that had been cut across the crops. The farmer had left a path across his crop. And it was, I just remember it being like a really vivid yellow. So from memory, I think he'd already sort of harvested the field, and whatever the stubble that was left was this just really bright yellow with this track going across it, less the other way around. Maybe it was the other way around and the track was bright yellow, but it's just the sort of contrast in the colours that caught my eye. You sort of head across the field, and then I sort of entered a wood eventually, which is right on the edge of the reserve. But that again was another sort of magical moment, and I sort of headed through this wood, and again, because it was so hot, it was humid, and I was getting bitten to death. And then you just emerge at this little gate, which sort of opens out to the top of the reserve, and I'm sort of standing there, and I could hear a couple of tawny owls hooting in the distance. I mean, bear in mind, this was about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. They were sort of hooting to each other, and there was a cuckoo, which is the first I'd heard in a long time. There was a cuckoo up in the woods at the top of the Prescombe Down. And then as I looked down into another bottom, I could see some guinea fowl sort of running around. And I mean, absolutely magical spot, really beautiful. And again, nobody there, had it to myself. But from there, I walked down into, again, the top of another bottom, and followed it all the way down, just heading down in the footpath that follows the bottom down to the bottom of the bottom. I was I couldn't quite see where I needed to go from there, but basically by this point you're trying to make your way back to Ebsbourne Wake. And I do remember sort of reaching the bottom at the lowest point of the sort of valley and looking up, and I could just about make out a gate, which was the way I wanted. So it was in front of me to the south, and to my left there was a gate and some sheep. And then as I looked like behind me, there's this herd of cows, and I don't know if they were black, so maybe they were Angus's, something like that. But they just sort of, I mean, they were almost silent. They were like ghosts coming across the hill, and they just silently ambled across the hill towards me. And I hadn't realised that they'd been sort of in the same field as me all along. Mm. And I, you know, I'm quite sort of comfortable in fields with cows that I know. So, the Longhorns at Parsonage Down, very comfortable with them. And of course, you and I, when we went to see Frankie Guy, we were in that field with her herd of Angus's and South Devons. And I must admit, that was a little bit not nerve-wracking, but I did, you don't know the cows, you don't know how they're going to react. And Frankie's obviously very comfortable with them, and was scratching the cows and giving them a cuddle, but they were damn big cows, weren't they?
They were, and they're strong, because I was stood by the back of the Land Rover, and one of them wanted to get to some of the hay in the back.
Yeah.
And just nudged forward, and I went flying.
Yeah,
I
mean,
I had no strength against the thing. And when that bloody big bull came over,
the bull was in there with us as well.
I know. I thought, oh my god.
Yeah. But it was astonishing when she said that one of those cows, the biggest one, weighs 1,000 kilograms.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a bloody big cow.
Yeah.
And I think sort of the average weight of the Longhorns at Parsonage Down is something like, I was chatting to the reserve manager the other day about this, and I thought, did he say 250, 350 kilograms? But they look tiny compared to the ones on Frankie's farm. But these, so the ones at Prescombe Down were sort of similar size. I should ask, actually, because Prescombe Down, he's also managed from Parsonage Down, where I work. So in the offices up there on the farm, at Cherry Lodge Farm, one of the people based in the office, Stevie Upton, she's responsible for Prescombe Down as well. So I should ask her what those cows are. But yeah, they sort of just ambled over the hill, and I mean, they were remotely interested in me. And so I sort of looked up and thinking, oh my God, I think I've got to go up there. And the climb up from that valley bottom to the gates, which it's so steep you actually lose sight of it.
Right.
And I was almost on my hands and knees climbing up there. And after a long day's really hot walking, that just about did for me. But it was well worth it. You get to the top and by the gate, and then you get a view back the way you've come down, but also off to my left. So I'm looking north now. Off to my left, there's another bottom that comes down, and the two of them sort of converge at the bottom of two bottoms now.
Yeah,
this is all getting very confusing. I was sort of sitting up on the hill, sort of surveying the scene, and it was, I mean, just beautiful. And I remember, because it was so hot, I was wearing shorts and a T-shirt, and I just sat in the grass, taking some photographs, which are on the blog, which I actually did in black and white. But I sat in the grass there for about half an hour. In fact, I think I even laid down. I could easily have gone to sleep there. But eventually sort of, you know, got up and headed off back to towards Ebsbourne Wake. And again, I'm not going to sort of try and explain the route I took back into Ebsbourne Wake. It's, you know, it's very clear from the map. In fact, it's so clear that I missed it and I went wrong. So
I have to say, your photos of that latter part of the route through Prescombe Down are absolutely stunning.
Yeah,
the views are just glorious.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you. And I sold a couple of prints, I think, of those views. There was a guy who contacted me through my website. I guess he must have seen the blog on Hidden Wiltshire, and he'd gone onto my website and contacted me through there. And yeah, he bought a couple of prints, quite big ones as well. But, you know, A2 prints. Mm. I did for him. I think it turned out that he had lived there. I think he lives in London now, but he'd lived down there when he was younger. So it just sort of evoked memories of his youth, I guess.
Yeah.
By this time, the sort of sun was, you know, not setting, because it was, you know, June, so not far off the longest day. But you know, it was starting to sort of go down a little bit, and so it was casting quite deep shadows, which I really like. And that's why I use black and white, because that looks much better, makes for better black and white photographs. Yeah, I think it was just too harsh for colour. And I think I took another one of the view of the church, Ebsbourne Wake Church, with the hills the other side of the valley. But of course, what I did discover later on that evening, that lying around in grassy meadows in shorts and a T-shirt is not a very bright idea. Because later on I found that I had 7 ticks. So I had to... My son's the expert tick extractor in our household. So he was there armed with the tick tweezers, pulling all these blooming ticks out of my back and my tops of my arms. I think that's my record so far in one sitting, is 7 ticks.
It's funny, because I think I've found that some people are just like tick magnets.
Yeah,
and you're clearly one of them.
I am, yeah.
Okay, shall we wrap up this week's podcast?
Yeah.
So the next Hidden Wiltshire and Wiltshire Museum walk is on the 30th of August, 2:30. That will be Earlstoke Wood and Salisbury Plain, where... if we can, we're going to try and get close to the one of the fields where they filmed 1917, the movie.
Yeah,
so that's something to look forward to.
So where's the meetup for that?
Probably behind the church in Earlstoke. There's a car park at the back of the church.
So it's right down in the oh, Earlstoke. No, I'm thinking of Cheverell. Yes, I know it.
Yeah,
It's
quite a good sized car park there.
Yeah. That used to be a good pub there as well, opposite
Yeah, I think it's reopened. Church.
Yeah, I think it has. Yeah, yeah. I drove past there fairly recently, and it looked like it opened.
Yeah.
But yeah, years ago, that was a very nice pub.
You and your pubs.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's quintessentially British, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
In fact, you can almost say English and Welsh. I must admit, my sort of forays to Scotland over the last couple of years, there don't seem to be quite so many up there. Yeah. Well, a lot of them they call bars, don't they? But
yeah.
So there's now like an English pub.
Yeah.
Or a Welsh pub, sorry.
Yeah, and a Welsh pub. The next episode in 2 weeks' time will be on the Coffin Trail between West Ashton and Steeple Ashton, which is an absolutely delightful walk, actually. But there's a lot of history to that as well, which will be fascinating to dip into.
Which, if you remember, we were going to do this week. So
we were.
Yeah, I think.
But we changed it because...
we're going to get done under the Trade Description Act or something for... not delivering on our promise.
Yeah.
But there was good reason for changing it. Steve Dixon, so again, shout out to Steve Dixon for doing all the music, composing, performing, all the rest of it. And he's on a roll at the moment. He sent me about 6 emails last night with more music, a couple of new compositions and some other stuff that I'd asked for from his SoundCloud account. I can't remember what I asked him for this one, but we'll put it in the show notes. So again, the website will have the show notes with links to all sorts of stuff, including Steve's SoundCloud. The Lower Boots offer, I did check with Tim Kington at the distributors, and that's very much still active. Not sure how many pairs of boots he sold on the back of this discount code, but you get a discount of 20% off Lower Boots and Shoes if you put in the discount code HW20 for HW for Hidden Wiltshire. So thanks Tim for the support there. I think that's the online shop, that's on the website as well, don't forget that.
Yeah that's still ticking along.
Yeah.
Getting a few orders through there, so that's good. That helps us keep the lights on.
Yeah. And you've put out a new newsletter, haven't you, as well?
Yes. So. I sent out a newsletter, not so much weekly anymore, but every so often. And if you check the social media stuff for Hidden Wiltshire, you'll see I put links to that up, and or you can subscribe to it via the website to get it into your inbox. So we will be back in 2 weeks' time. So thanks for listening, and goodbye.
Ta-da.